are listening to Up to Me Radio, the best in inspirational talk radio. It's up to me.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of A Healthier View with yours truly, Scott Clitheroe and Beth. Hey, Beth.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, fantastic. It's so good to be back. How you doing? How's your December going?
It's going very well. I can't believe Christmas is just right around the corner.
Oh my gosh. You know, it's the late Thanksgiving seems to have thrown people off. You know, it seems like Thanksgiving was a little bit later in the month, so it seemed like there was a little bit of a delay in people getting up decorations in my neighborhood, but boy, they've made up for it. And now it's looking like Christmas, a little bit more like Christmas.
I thought you were going to break out in a song there.
Oh, no, I love our listeners too much to sing.
That's so funny.
I can carry a bucket, but I can't carry a tune.
Yeah, I'm with you. We have our talents in the health and wellness world, don't we?
Yes, exactly. Well, we don't want to keep him waiting, Beth, so I'm really anxious to get to our episode today with Dr. Osborne. So with that, we'll be back after this message.
180 over 111, and I had a stroke.
I couldn't speak or walk.
150 over 90, and I had a stroke.
This is what high blood pressure sounds like. You might not feel its symptoms, but the results from a stroke are far from silent. Get back on your treatment plan or talk with your doctor to create a plan that works for you. Go to loweryourhbp.org.
Head to toe, everything's changed.
Brought to you by the American Stroke Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.
I'd like to welcome Dr. Peter Osborne to our show. He is the director of Origins Healthcare in Sugar Land, Texas. He's a chiropractor, a doctor of pastoral science, a board-certified clinical nutritionist, author of a best-selling book called No Grain, No Pain. He's often referred to as the gluten-free warrior and is one of the most sought-out after alternative and nutritional experts in the world. So thank you so much, Dr. Osborne, for taking the time out of your busy day, and welcome to our show.
Well, I'm honored to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Osborne, again, just to reiterate, thank you so much for coming by. I know you're busy, and we really appreciate your desire to help us educate our audience. And I kind of want to just, again, a lot of the questions I'm asking for myself, but I'm sure some of our audience members have the same question. But I'd just like you to kind of tell us what is meant by functional medicine.
Oh, absolutely. So functional medicine is really kind of a rebirth of many other terms that people have heard in the past, like holistic medicine or comprehensive medicine. Some mistakenly call it integrative medicine or alternative medicine. But what functional medicine really is it's the science and the art, the pursuit of the reason why versus a traditional allopathic model, which is the pursuit of the attacking, I shouldn't say attacking, maybe the wrong word, the pursuit of mitigating symptoms, like symptom management versus root cause resolution is really probably the biggest differential between the two. Whereas in functional medicine, if somebody has a chronic degenerative disease, let's use diabetes as the example. Diabetes is a disease of choice and lifestyle. If we're talking about traditional adult onset diabetes, not type 1. So type 2 diabetes is a choice. But in allopathic care, the kind of the mantra or the approach is to medicate with drugs that improve insulin sensitivity, or with drugs that lower lipids or with drugs that lower blood pressure, because those are all kind of convening factors for the increased risk of metabolic diseases. We look at it differently in functional medicine. We say, okay, what is it that you're currently doing in your life that's actually driving your blood sugars to be higher than what your body can handle, and the subsequent response of that high blood sugar obviously increases the risk for a number of different health issues. So if we could understand what the person was doing, whether it's eating too much sugar or whether it's eating other foods that have glycemic responses in that individual uniquely. Because I've seen cases where diabetes was induced by broccoli and cauliflower. I've seen cases where diabetes was induced by grains like gluten or gluten sensitivity. Mm-hmm. So it's unique and different for the person. And that's really the difference in functional medicines. We're trying to ascertain what the underlying origin or root cause of the issue is for the unique person, as opposed to generalizing everybody with type 2 diabetes and saying, all of you have this disease for the exact same reason, and we're going to generalize you into a particular category. We look at the individual, kind of like in research studies. You know, when doctors do research studies, they usually take large bodies of people, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we look at it in functional medicine as each patient is a research study. N equals one, in essence, instead of N equaling 10,000 or 15,000, N equals one. And so what we want to find out and isolate about that unique person is what is unique about their choices, unique about their internal biochemistry that's predisposing them or putting them in the position where their body is responding to their behaviors in a way that it manifests the symptoms of disease. And then we classify them into that disease category so that then we can then start medicating that disease instead of asking why the disease exists. I know I rambled on there for a minute, but I wanted to just kind of give you some examples.
You know, this is so interesting to me. And I know for me, functional medicine is something I'm really diving into as a consumer with you, Dr. Osborne, but also in my professional world as a wellness manager in the oil companies, I really try to encourage people to exercise regularly, eat simply, keep stress levels down, try to get quality sleep, take the supplements. But I want to know, how did you get into functional medicine?
Well, I was early on. I was an obese child. Fifth grade, sixth grade, I was easily 50 pounds overweight. And, you know, as a young kind of pubescent child growing into a man, you know, we want to be noticed by girls, right?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of look at this as the core precursor to my journey was I was wanting to be interested or interesting by the other sex. And so, you know, part of my journey was recognizing that I was overweight. And one of the things that we grew up kind of poor. I grew up in a large family, lots of brothers and sisters, five brothers and sisters. And, you know, what we ate was not good. It wasn't very healthy food. And so my brother was skinny as a rail, but for me, it made me fat as a rail or fat as the opposite of a rail. Right.
Uh-huh. I got really
interested in sports as a means to lose weight. And so I've started playing basketball and started jogging and took up some weightlifting. And so really just started to try to move the needle in the right direction for myself. And even with my food, I tried to start recognizing what I should or shouldn't be eating. And of course, at the time that the kind of the mantra back in those days, which was the early 80s, which was, you know, low fat diet. And so I was really fat conscious, really calorie conscious, and it helped me lose some weight, and it actually helped me get in pretty good shape. So that was kind of my early on, you know, before I ever got into school, my early on experience. But what really drove me into it was one of my original patients. I did an externship in the VA hospital in rheumatology, and in that department, what I was seeing, where I was seeing people coming through that department, and I was in this externship, and I was given this primer on rheumatological disease. And I was told, you need to read this book, and you need to come to the hospital every day, and you need to kind of know everything that's in this book so that you can be ready to learn even more. And so I did. I'm a student. I study and I can memorize. I can tell you page 3, chapter 4 or paragraph 4, because that's the mind that I have. I've been gifted with that kind of mind. So I prepared for this externship in rheumatology. And so reading through the rheumatological science, what I found was here, all the researchers were saying things that trigger autoimmune disease are environmental things, right? So we knew that there were several different triggers. A number of the triggers for some of the autoimmune diseases were infection. Like, for example, Lyme disease is notorious for creating a type of rheumatoid arthritis. We knew that certain types of chemical exposures, you know, petrochemicals, pesticides, things of that nature could trigger diseases like Graves, could trigger or help to trigger diseases like spondyloarthropathies, you know, which are rheumatological, basically arthritis type diseases, and they're very debilitating. And so here I'm like, what I'm being told by my attending physician is we don't know what causes it, but what I'm reading in the book that they demanded that I read and learn is that we have all these different triggers that we know of. And so I started writing them out and classifying these different triggers into categories. And what I came to the conclusion of was there were four categorical triggers, if we were to just call them categories. And one of the categories of triggers was infectious microorganisms. So things like Lyme or Klebsiella or Pseudomonas aeruginosa, different types of bacterial infections could trigger an autoimmune response. The second trigger was food. We knew very clearly, because the research already showed us the perfect model of autoimmune disease where we knew the cause. And that was celiac disease, which is caused by gluten sensitivity or caused by gluten. So food being a trigger. And when I dove into the research, I learned that it wasn't just gluten that could cause villus atrophy in celiac. You could see the same thing happen with soy. You could see the same thing happen with a parasite infection. You could see the same thing happen with corn proteins. So again, it brought into the category of food as being a major trigger. And then the third category was chemical exposure. And there was a lot of research, even 20 years ago at the time, on different pesticides and different pesticide exposures as being major culprits or triggers for autoimmunity. And then the fourth trigger was nutritional deficit. And we had some really great research, again, even 20 years ago, on vitamin D. Vitamin D deficiency all by itself can be a precursor to rheumatological arthritis. So here you've got four categories. You've got food, you've got infection, you've got chemical exposure, and you've got vitamin and mineral deficiencies. And so thinking about that just as an analytical person does, and then looking at what we were offering in the hospital as a treatment modality, and the treatment modality was for these people with rheumatology diseases was what's called a DMARD, a disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drug. The most common one that was used at the time was something called methotrexate, which was an old cancer drug. So basically this drug suppressed the replication of DNA and RNA, and it reduced pain, but at the same time, it caused the inability for the person to heal, and it damaged their gut lining to such a severe degree that it caused what's known today as intestinal hyperpermeability or leaky gut, which we know is also a cause of autoimmune disease. So the main treatment was actually inducing a scenario of the GI tract that would perpetuate their disease indefinitely, requiring them to always be on the medication and to never actually fully heal. Mm-hmm. But over the time and the lifespan of using that drug, what we found is their health deteriorated. It didn't improve. Their pain was reduced. And so their quality of life was okay in that regard to pain and pain management, but the disease progression didn't change. And so what would happen is these people would be on methotrexate for 10 or 15 years, and they'd be on other drugs too. Steroids was a common medication that was being used with acute pain scenarios. And as were non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, things like ibuprofen, right? Over the counter, naproxen. And then also, this was at the time I was in this was the time when biologics were just kind of first coming online. So those weren't the mainstay at that point. But steroids and non-steroidals and DMARDs were the class of drugs that these people were being put on for years and years. And what would end up happening is their joint destruction would be just as inevitable as if they weren't on the medication. And so then the surgeons would come in and they'd do a surgical consult, and then they'd end up replacing their joints. And so after 15 years of being medicated with drugs that destroy the gut lining, right? Because when you combine a steroid with an NSAID, you destroy the gut lining. It causes ulcers. When you take a methotrexate, it destroys the gut lining. And when you take all three, there's a synergism that really destroys their capacity at absorbing. And so now they become malnourished over the years of using this drug. And then you put them under a scheduled trauma, like a surgery, and they don't recover very well. And so you have a lot of failed surgeries. And to me, that was not acceptable. And even being the young and naive person that I was, I was told to read the book. I read the book. Here are the triggers. So I go back to the attending and I say, look, these are the triggers. You told me to read the book, and this is what the book says. What you're telling me is there are no triggers. What the book is telling me is that there are categorical triggers. Why don't we start investigating these categorical triggers and see and doing some intervention to see if we can make any different changes or improvements? I was promptly told no. And then I went back to the research, and I found something else. I found that you could fast a person in acute autoimmune pain for 48 hours, and you could see their pain almost virtually go away. Wow. And so I brought that research back to the attending and I said, look, why don't we do just a small trial? Well, we fast people. Let's do some 24-hour, 48-hour, you know, let's just do some fasting and just see what happens. It won't hurt them, but it could potentially help them. I was promptly told no. And then I went back one more time to the drawing board and pulled research on the potency of omega-3 fatty acids, particularly EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid, as a as a tool to modulate inflammation to reduce pain. And there was some research coming out in some surgical journals at the time that showed that high doses of fish oil was equally effective as a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory at pain reduction. So I thought, okay, there's prescription fish oil. This is not too far from a field from what is the wheelhouse. Why don't we put a small group of people on prescription high-dose fish oil and see if that doesn't help their pain? And I was again promptly told no. And so after that frustration, three strikes, you're out kind of deal, I left and started my own practice. And one of my very first patients in private practice was a little girl. Her name was Ginger. And when her mom brought her to see me, she was nine, but Ginger was diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis at the age of two. She, you know, her condition was so severe that her knees would swell up to the size of grapefruits. Imagine a two-year-old with grapefruit-sized knees. Can't crawl, can't walk, can't play on the playground, not functional, not social. She starts methotrexate at the age of two, and she takes methotrexate for 7 years. And at the age of nine, she goes in to the rheumatologist, and rheumatologist looks at this little girl's mom and says, you know, we're very, very sorry. There's not any more that we can do for her. We don't think she's got more than 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And they said, you need to just go home and get your affairs in order and probably start thinking about this reality. And so when Ginger's mom brought her in to see me, of course, she was in total tears. And, you know, I was young. She was one of my first patients. I was just starting to develop a reputation for food-induced disease and being known for that. And so one of the first things we did with Ginger was we checked her for gluten sensitivity, and we checked her for other food antigen reactions. And what we found with her was pretty unique. It wasn't unique in regards to gluten. She was definitely gluten sensitive, and that made a major, major change in how she felt. But she was also allergic to blueberries. Now, blueberries, by most people's thought process, is a superfood. You hear about it all the time. It wasn't until we actually applied a gluten-free, what I call a true gluten-free diet, which is really not a wheat, barley, rye-free diet, but it's a grain-free diet. There's no corn, rice, oats, or sorghum, or millet, or teff, or quinoa, or buckwheat, or amaranth allowed on this type of diet. And what we saw within 6 months was her knees normalized, and she was off the pain medication.
Wow.
And when she came to see me, she had a stent in her arm that was permanently embedded for pain, IV pain medication. We were able to get that pulled. And within a year, she was in full remission. And then from that point, she just stayed in full remission. And here, just a few years ago, she graduated college and she's out in the world doing wonderful things. And that was my first like mega experience into the realm of the power of what I had learned. So, I mean, I had learned, you know, and that's the whole thing, right? It's kind of like in school, you learn how things work. And then when you go out in the real world and start applying them, sometimes they don't work the way the textbook reads.
Yeah.
But this was my real world application of, okay, all that research that I had put together and done in the VA hospital came to such a fruition that it hit me like a freight train because, you know, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis is not common. But if we look at autoimmune disease as a whole, autoimmune disease is the number one cause of death in females under the age of 65. In the U.S. alone, there's 65 million cases of autoimmune disease, and that's an underestimation because we now believe that type 2 diabetes is autoimmune and that many of the different forms of cardiovascular disease, like pericarditis, also have an autoimmune origin, and that osteoporosis has an autoimmune origin, and that Alzheimer's has an autoimmune origin, and that cancer actually is end-stage autoimmune disease. There's all this new evidence and research coming out that shows that autoimmune disease is kind of like the immune system being so embattled by the environment that it basically destroys the body slowly over time. And so with all of this, I knew that this message had to reach more people. And I, you know, in my small practice in Sugar Land, where, you know, I'm working Monday through Friday, seeing at the time, you know, maybe 400 or 500 patients a year, when there's 46 million people that have this diagnosis and have the same answers as Ginger had. which to me was not acceptable. And I, you know, I was just very, very motivated to try to get as much of this information out into the massive population as I could. And so at that time, I started a foundation called Gluten Free Society, and with the whole intent and purpose of doing two things. Number one is educating the population on how gluten played a role in a lot of different diseases, not just celiac disease. And so we started writing and we started blogging and we started drawing the science that had been being done by some great researchers. I can't take credit for the science. I was like a reporter reporting on the science.
Yeah.
And so we started creating this platform of education where people could come and learn more about the long lasting and the far reaching effects of gluten. But I also created a science-based, research-based 10-hour postgraduate course so that I could start training doctors, because I knew that I had to get this information into the hands of doctors, because that's really where the decisions were going to be being made usually. Is where the doctor can guide the patient down the right path. And so this was, you know, back in 2008 when we started putting all this together, 2010 when we formally launched the site, and we've just been going full steam ahead ever since.
That's awesome. Boy, there's so much to ask there. I got to ask you. I mean, I'm not sure if this is really where we want to take this this discussion, but I got to ask you, because I think I may know some of the answers, but what was the resistance? Why the resistance back at the VA back in those days? I mean, I think I know the answer to that, but, you know, I mean, you're in an academic center where they're, you know, part of an academic center, you know, they're in the medical center. Why the resistance, you think?
I think, you know, I think there were several reasons. I think one, VA hospital is a monster red tape,
yeah,
political machine, and to make any kind of change is hard to do. But for a young intern to come in, you know, who's green behind the ears, to say all these things that I believe were profound and could have huge impact,
yeah,
to, you know, existing doctors who've been in practice 30 plus years, there's an ego thing there, there's a red tape thing,
yeah,
there's, you know, there's all kinds of things there. But you know, that those are all just my own speculation. Nobody ever gave me a direct answer as,
yeah,
to why they,
well, I mean, I guess,
they wouldn't do that.
I wonder though if you wouldn't have gotten the same answer if you were actually at an academic center. I mean, not even, you know, yeah, definitely you were an intern and maybe there's some of that, but I mean, I just, again, I'm speaking as a physician. I just feel like sometimes, I think it's getting better. And I think maybe just in my community, it seems to be more awareness of all the things that we don't understand and the openness to learning from other areas of interest and research. But I just feel like there's still some resistance at times. And I hope that we can get through that and get over that.
I honestly predict that big data is changing it all, mm-hmm, and will change it all, because, you know, 20 years ago, the internet was there, but it was kind of more of a message board than anything else. Today, it's this,
yeah,
place where people can go and share their experiences. And so, you know, the truth has a sense of resonation, you know, when you hear it, right? Truth resonates. And I think there are enough people now discovering that they don't want to be on immunosuppressants and steroids and DMARDs for the rest of their life. And so they're actually having open discussions with each other about it. And some of them have been brave enough to actually journey that road of diet change and lifestyle change. And their stories are just ringing in a big way to the masses, because we have this ability to share the data whereas before, mm-hmm, you know, how many people in your neighborhood do you know with rheumatoid arthritis? Like,
yeah,
you know, nobody talked about it. I mean, we grew, I mean, right, our culture was, our parents didn't talk. You didn't talk about disease. You didn't talk about your problem.
Not at all.
You presented your best self to the world and you sucked it up and took it all for the team.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of coming into a new generation of people who are tired of doing that, I think. And that's a good thing.
That's a really good thing. I mean, do you find in your own practice, and I guess in just the community, are the insurance companies beginning to accept, you know, functional medicine? And is there any payers that are open to providing coverage for these type of testing and interventions?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I can actually share an anecdote on that. I was in the insurance model, you know, the first probably 5 years of practice before leaving it, because I got tired, mm-hmm, of third parties intervening. But the one of the big insurance companies, I won't mention who they are, but they requisitioned 10 of my charts. They wanted to do a chart review because what they wanted to see was why I was doing all these different testing. I was doing different kind of nutritional testing and tox testing and things that were not part of the standard of their statistics of my type of doctor. So they were looking into me to try to either tell me to quit doing it or to find out why I was doing it. So I gave them the 10 charts they asked for. And they came back at me and asked for a refund for all of those people. And this is over a number of years. And I said, well, why? They said, because it's not part of what your peers do. And so we're calling it non-standard of care, therefore not medically necessary. I said, yeah, did you look at the outcomes of those 10 charts? So like, yeah, I know that you looked at what we did, but did you look at the medical bills as they moved forward in life, right? And so when we actually analyzed the cost of what they spent initially in my office versus the long-term cost of their healthcare moving forward, it was dramatically lower. I said, those are the numbers that you really need to be looking at because those are the numbers that are going to save you the most money. And they ignored those numbers. We showed them the numbers. We actually had the data. I came to find out later, I talked to one of the higher ups and what he told me, I said, look, why aren't you guys covering this? I said, you'll save trillions of dollars as an industry. I mean, our healthcare bill is $3.2 trillion. How much disease and how much hospitalization and how much medication, how much of all that could we actually save? He said, you know what, we're not interested in that. And one of the reasons why we're not interested in that is because the reality is if we were to start paying for these people to see a functional medicine practitioner, the reality is they're not going to stay with us. That patient is only going to be with us on average 2 to 3 years before they move and shift companies. So what's going to happen is we're going to be paying for their care and then they're going to move on and we're not going to reap the reward or the benefit.
Somebody else gets the benefits. Oh,
right.
Oh,
but so my argument was, well, if that's true, but you all did it, because if one of you did it, you would all follow suit. I mean, that's the way it works. Then you would all reap the benefits, you know, in mass. He's like, you could create more wealth than you ever dreamed of if you actually started covering what mattered. Not that emergency care doesn't matter. Not that allopathic medicine doesn't matter. Certainly there are exceptions in all cases. But you know, the fact of the matter is that most diseases that you see in your acute care scenario are because people get to a point where they've destroyed themselves to such a great degree that they're now in a dire strait. Not because, absolutely. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't want to misspeak here, but I mean, I'm sure you see your fair share of acute trauma from car accidents or, you know, acute injuries, but the vast majority of acute care comes from chronic cases of people having chronic disease where their body's just broken down to the point they end up in the ER, right?
Absolutely. And that statement from that insurance company representative is such an indictment of our healthcare system. I mean, if that's not a summation of the problem, it's, you know, it's not looking at the whole picture. It's our own little silo of profit and all that. And that, boy, that's frustrating. That's frustrating to hear, but that's so true. They don't look at the big picture, the long-term picture of a person's health. It's that month or that year or that, you know, 3 years, like you said. Boy, that's frustrating to hear. It really is. Oh.
You know, I'd like to kind of shift the conversation to one of your books. You've written many books, Dr. Osborne, one of them being No Grain, No Pain. Can you tell our audience, in layman's terms, about the history and hazards of eating grain?
Absolutely. You know, the myth is that, you know, you read that grain is the staff of life, right? Or wheat is the staff of life. You know, there's certainly biblical reference to grain. I will call attention to one of the biblical references in Genesis, and I'm going to paraphrase here. I'm not going to direct quote, because this is one of the arguments I get, which is, well, you know, if it's in the Bible, why shouldn't we eat it? But when God cast Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, one of the things he mentioned was that you will toil in the fields and grain will be your sustenance. Like, he was punishing. And I'm not a biblical scholar. I can't interpret what he meant. But to me, that seems like a punishment. You can no longer have the fruit of the tree. You now have to go and toil in the fields to get nourishment. And part of your toil will actually be the damage that the food causes to your health. Maybe I'm misreading that. Maybe I'm not. Again, I'm not a biblical scholar. I don't claim to know the exact meaning of that phrase, but I always found it interesting. But beyond that, if we just look at the short history of grain as a staple food in the human diet, a lot of people think it goes back to biblical days where grain was used as the primary food And it was in like the Fertile Crescent. There were areas where farming took over. And so, you know, growing crops of food, and not just grain, but other foods as well, became easier than hunting and gathering. And it allowed for the development of technology, and it allowed for people to do other things with their time, like develop technologies and learn more about the world around them and create kind of a growing body of knowledge so that, you know, so that we could have all of the things that we have today, like the combustible engine or nuclear power, right? I mean, these things came as a result of us not having to expend all of our energy trying to find food. And so it's a double-edged sword in the sense that, you know, part of what grain allowed us to do was not starve as a society, but part of what it did is it created a chronic illness that made us sick as a society. And if you look at modern grain today, most people think, like, for example, that cereal has been around forever, and it hasn't. Cereal is an invention from about 1895, when some of the first machines were developed as a result of the Industrial Revolution. Some of the first machines were developed to shred wheat and to create a cereal from it. And then one of the doctors at the time, I'm sure you've heard of Kellogg's, Dr. Kellogg, he was a GI doc, and his brother was a marketer, a businessman, and they developed cornflakes. And they developed it at a time to irritate the gut lining to alleviate constipation. And so that's the history that people don't know about the cereal, is that it wasn't really designed as a health food. It was designed as a gut irritant to alleviate constipation, because a lot of your rural people were over-consuming meat, and so they were constipated. So that was kind of the solution for that, was gut irritation. And then Post came along with Grape Nuts, and so those are kind of your first two cereals. And then from the late 1800s to about 1910, we saw astronomical increases in gastrointestinal inflammatory disorders. And Dr. B.B. Crone, the doctor whose
name was coined
for Crohn's disease, right? This is a lot where that came from, was after the advent of cereal. And so when cereal became a major staple, it happened in 1943. So after about 40 to 50 years of cereal use in mass, the government stepped out and banned the sale of processed cereal, because it was responsible for about 8,000 deaths a year because it was causing beriberi and pellagra, which are B vitamin deficiency diseases. So what was happening, you take these grains and you would convert them into cereal, and there would be no vitamin B1 and there would be no vitamin B3, niacin or thiamine in these products. And so people would develop, you know, congestive heart failure, neurological failure as a result of beriberi. They've developed pellagra, which basically it causes severe skin inflammation and increases the risk for infection and causes diarrhea until they die. So these are very terminal B vitamin deficiency disorders. And so people were dying, again, to the tune of about 8,000 deaths a year. So the government says, and you can no longer sell these cereal products unless you fortify them. And this is where a lot of our fortification came from. So when you look at a box of cereal, a loaf of bread, a box of pasta, you'll look at the back and it says fortified with, and then you'll see the word thiamine and you'll see the word niacin and you'll see some other things too. There's usually folic acid and there's usually iron fortification. So there's a number of different things that these products are being fortified with. But what the cereal manufacturers at the time did, actually went back and collected some of the old ads from the time, some of the old commercial ads. In 1943 was Kellogg's that posted an ad that says, "Now our cereal is even better for you because it's fortified with vitamins and minerals." And so instead of saying we were killing people because our cereal was malnourishing you, they turned the table. This is where the marketing comes in and the message, right? And so they said, instead of killing you, now we're even better for you. And so it was that message, and you grew up with it. I grew up with it. It's that, you know, now a part of your daily balanced breakfast, fortified with vitamins and minerals, a part of your daily balanced breakfast. You can remember every cartoon character in the world being created and thrown at you. Tony the Tiger, the Leprechaun, you know, the Count Chocula, all those, you know, characters designed at mass acceptance of a social paradigm that cartoon characters basically sold the will of our generations to think that cereal was somehow an always there food that was part of our culture when it was actually a new advent that was less than 100 years old, that was killing people. And then when we fortified it with synthetic vitamins, it quit killing people with beriberi and pellagra, and it just killed them much more slowly. And then when we started scale farming after the Great Depression, after the 30s and the Great Depression, the government subsidized the growth of grain because they didn't want farmers to go out of business, because they didn't want the country to starve to death, which was a noble thing to do and the right thing to do. But when you subsidize taxpayer dollars to grow grain, to save farmers, and you never remove those subsidies. The subsidies are still in place today. And now today, the farmers are not your mom and pop farmers. You've got big corporate conglomerations with genetically modified patent protected seeds and sprays and everything else that are being paid by your tax dollars to chemically manipulate and chemically grow these products and hybridize, genetically hybridize them in ways that are never really proven as safe or effective. Or the studies are done for 6 months, and when nobody dies after 6 months, they say they're safe and effective. And this has all been pawned on to the population as if it's always been this way, and it hasn't. And so that's kind of the history of grain, aside from the fact that, you know, commercialized farming today and commercialized storing of grains tends to lead toward fungal growth on the grain. There's a lot of fungals or fungi that grow on the grain, like Aspergillus and Cladosporium, and these fungus produce mycotoxins, which are basically they're mold toxins that can shut down the kidney and cause cancer and suppress the immune function. And so you've got lots of mold in the grain and the grain storage. You've got the fact that everybody's eating more grain today than they've ever eaten in the history of mankind. It's no longer just a little bit of grain. It's now grain for breakfast, grain for lunch, grain for dinner. And they take the grain today and to make it chewier and doughier, they've genetically manipulated it, they've hybridized it, but they've also taken gluten and they've added extra gluten to make, you know, grain more chewy and more palatable. So now we're, you know, when we say, why are we seeing this today when we didn't see it in 1950 to this degree? Well, these are some of the reasons. There are other reasons too, but these are some of those reasons. Then you take into effect the fact that, you know, since 1980, 33,000 new chemicals have been introduced to the air, to the water, and to our food supply. And, you know, any chemist can tell you that when you add one chemical to another, it creates something called synergism. And so the effect is not like 1 + 1, but the effect is 1 × 10 × 10 × 10 × 10. And the predictability of knowing how all these chemicals interact with human physiology toward bad health or good health is unknown, yet it's all called safe. And if we look at we plot autoimmune disease, because this is where my passion is autoimmune disease. We know grain causes autoimmune disease. We've known it for a very long time. But if we plot kind of the course of autoimmune disease since the 1950s, autoimmune disease was relatively low. And we plot autoimmune disease on a graph when chemical introduction occurred in U.S. agriculture and when chemical introduction occurred in the vaccine schedule, where the vaccines went from a handful of vaccines to kids to now I think it's up to 47 injections and shots that they now have to get by the time they're 18. None of these things have safety tests. None of these things have long-term safety data, and we know it, and we've known it all along, and the FDA is lying and the CDC is lying, and nobody's got any data to show us that these things are safe. And you look at all this chemical intervention and you look at the curve of autoimmune disease and you see those two, and I know that correlation is not causation, but you know, this is something that needs to be investigated. This is something that needs to be studied. And in my opinion, grain is playing a major role in that process, because grain serves for many people to weaken the immune system, because not only is gluten a very, very common entity, gluten sensitivity is a very, very common issue, but we've also got the fact that grains are seeds. And let's just go back to basic biology 101. All seeds are designed for one purpose, and that is to perpetuate their own species while preventing predation from eating it into extinction. And so that being said, you've got a seed that can't run away from your mouth, right? So it has to have the ability to fight or wage some type of chemical warfare so that it can continue to exist. And all things in Mother Nature's fold have this ability. As humans, we have the ability to run away, fight, you know, create guns and weapons. But plants don't, right? So they have intrinsic chemicals that they've evolved over time that help keep them alive and keep them perpetuating. And we've enhanced those things through genetic hybridization. We've made them all better at surviving weeds, better at surviving pests, better at surviving drought and in other aspects of Mother Nature's forces, including us. And so when you make that a staple food and you make 60 to 80% of the daily caloric intake a food that's designed to protect itself from predators to survive by destroying human digestion, of course you're going to have chronic illness as an outcome when you make that the staple food of a society.
That's interesting. You know, listen to you talk, I think about that book, Sapiens by Harari, where he talked about how we didn't domesticate wheat. Wheat domesticated us. And that just really sprang to my mind when you kind of gave us that history. It's really amazing how that grass has kind of really entered into our world, you know, and caused some pretty bad health outcomes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, the double-edged sword is we have to be hesitant to kind of go blaming it too bad. I know that maybe not the right words for the gluten-free warrior to be saying, but I think ultimately we have to look at how we can eat well and live well and take advantage of the technologies in our life that has made our lives better and do it all at the same time. You know, and I think that's the conversation that needs to come to light in farming. I think that's the conversation that needs to come to light in industry. It's not, I don't think that we necessarily, you know, I'm known for talking against grain, but I don't think we necessarily start by demonizing farmers and demonizing companies that have tried to scale the production of it to prevent starvation. I think we have to have a different conversation about how we need to restore the soil and how we need to restore farming practices to something that's scalable, but also healthy for humans to consume without developing chronic disease.
Yeah. Dr. Osborne, you know, one thing that I have struggled with as a physician when I have a patient in the hospital is helping patients find functional medicine providers in the community, not just Austin. But do you have any suggestions for our listeners when they're listening to you and they don't live in the Houston area? How do they go about, you know, finding a provider that they can maybe do the testing you do? Is there an organization that oversees this that they can look to, or any suggestions?
There are a couple of different organizations. There's the Institute for Functional Medicine. I'm not affiliated or part of that organization. That's, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Jeffrey Bland. He was one of Linus Pauling's students, but he's the founder of that organization. And there are a number of doctors. I think at to date, there are about 15,000 doctors that are going through or have gone through that program. And then there's also Functional Medicine University, which is which I'm on their board. I'm one of their board of advisors. And this group is just another group. It's kind of like Coke and Pepsi, right? It's just two different groups that oversee the education of functional medicine training for providers. And so either one of those groups you could look up online and you could kind of go see who that would be a great place to start. I would say this though, in functional medicine is a tricky bird. And what I mean by that is, you either love it or you need to get out. And I feel very, very passionate about that because it's kind of like emergency medicine. You either love it or you get out there's no room for people who don't love it. There's no room for people to make the errors and to make the mistakes. You know what I mean? Like in your world, it's high paced, fast paced. You've got to know what it is that you're doing and you've got to be good and quick on your feet. And functional medicine is that way. Although it's not an acute scenario where somebody's going to die today, because we don't run acute care clinics, but you either love it or you don't. And a lot of people, unfortunately, do what I call, what's a nice way to put it? They dabble in it. They dabble in it because either it's popular, and so they're trying to kind of shift over to that a little bit, or they dabble in it because some doctors are dabbling in it because there's a revenue resource, a cash revenue source. And you know, those are the wrong reasons to be a functional medicine practitioner, right? The passion has to be there. So when you're looking for somebody, first and foremost, find somebody who's got some type of credentialing where they've trained. Mm-hmm. Second of all, find somebody who's passionate and they love what they do, like they eat, breathe, and sleep it, and they live it. Thirdly, if it's functional medicine, try to find somebody with some experience. And I don't say this to like belittle those guys that are gals that are out there that are just getting going. But it's one of those things that it's like beef. It gets better as it ages. It's like fine wine. It gets better as it ages because the experience and the wisdom that comes with years of practice, especially when it comes to complex, conditions with multiple variables and multiple environmental factors, like you can't piecemeal that stuff. Yeah. So my advice to your audience is if you're looking for a practitioner, first ask them what their credentials are. Second, ask them how long they've been in practice. Mm-hmm. And look for somebody with some years of experience, not with some months of experience. And some doctors will say, yeah, I've been in practice 20 years. Then the next question should be, well, yeah, but when did you graduate your functional medicine courses? Because maybe you were practicing conventional medicine for 19 years and you just graduated the functional medicine world. I see a lot of that today. A lot of that's popping up. And I get a lot of people in my clinic that have been to who they thought were functional medicine practitioners, and they weren't.
Yeah.
They were either dabbling, or they were people that I don't know, they were piecemealing. Piecemealing is another problem that we have, is that they take a allopathic approach to functional medicine. No offense to allopathic doctors, but functional medicine is not allopathy. And that's the thing. Like, green medicine is the term I use. You can't throw natural things at a person to reduce their symptoms and call it functional medicine. That's called naturopathic. That's where you're using, instead of using naproxen to reduce somebody's pain, you can use high-dose turmeric, high-dose quercetin, high-dose vitamin C. It's just as effective.
Yeah.
But you're still practicing green medicine. You're not practicing functional medicine. Functional medicine is when you ascertain the underlying origin of why the pain exists. And if you're looking for that, then don't get sucked into green medicine, which is just a natural approach to medicate symptoms using something that is not a pharmaceutical.
That's great advice. Great advice. Thank you.
You know, I know we're running out of time, but I have one last question. I actually heard an interview you did. And in this interview, you mentioned that if you were stranded on an island, the one vitamin that you would want would be vitamin C. So I think when people think of vitamin C, they think of immunity, and you take it cold season, flu season. But what are some ailments that people don't think about when it comes to vitamin C helping out?
So vitamin C is like human duct tape. You can use duct tape to pretty much fix anything, right? Well, vitamin C is like that. And if I could only choose one thing, the reason why I would choose vitamin C is because universally it's an antioxidant. So it helps your mitochondria repair. It helps your body tissues repair. It helps prevent free radical damage. It's a natural process of a natural byproduct of the aging process and of metabolism. But vitamin C is also very critical for normal liver function. So it helps the liver basically take out the trash. It's a natural chelator. So if you're exposed to any type of heavy metal, vitamin C is going to help naturally chelate those things out. Vitamin C is necessary to vasodilate. So in order for your blood vessels to properly dilate and your blood pressure to be normal, and for you to make something called nitric oxide, which is a Nobel Prize winning chemical of a few years ago that regulates heart disease, you need vitamin C. That's just getting warmed up. I mean, I take vitamin C personally. I take 5 grams a day. That's my bowel tolerance of vitamin C. I won't stop doing that. And I took that lesson from, and I can't take credit for all the great vitamin C research, that I give that credit to Linus Pauling, who was quoted in his lab when he was in his 90s. Somebody was there and interviewing him and said, all of the people around you say that, high dose vitamin C is dangerous. What do you have to say to these critics? He says, I'm still in my lab in my 90s and they're all dead. Something is to be said for that. So, I like vitamin C.
You did mention GI tolerance, because I think as I've had patients tell me that they have a hard time with, over 1 or 2 grams, but I guess it is, individual. Do you have any suggestions for folks who may not be able to tolerate it? Can you take it with food? Or I know that obviously it has to do with the acidification, of the gut or of the stomach. Any suggestions?
So the biggest tolerance is that vitamin C as ascorbate, as pure ascorbate, will pull water into the bowel. So it'll create at first like a gurgling or a rumbling, and then it'll create loose bowels, and then it'll create diarrhea. So if you're taking vitamin C and you're trying to hit heavier or higher doses, number one, don't take more than 1 gram at a time, and space it out over the course of your day. And so there's another thing that can be done. It's called a vitamin C flush. And kind of the simple way to do this is spend a day at home. Don't do this on a day where you got any plans. You want to just stay home. You're going to do this on an empty stomach, because it's like prepping for a colonoscopy, right? You're going to be going to the bathroom a lot. But you take 2 teaspoons of vitamin C powder, as pure ascorbate. It needs to be pure buffered ascorbate. which is about 6 grams, 2 teaspoons every 15 minutes mixed in 3 ounces of water. You're going to just take that back until you start having diarrhea. Once you start having diarrhea, discontinue the vitamin C. Now, you calculate the quantity of vitamin C that it took to induce that flush. That flush is the diarrhea. So mm-hmm. for most people, it's going to take anywhere between 15 and 40 grams of a pure ascorbate to actually hit a flush. And so once you know what that level is for you, you can take that number and basically cut it in half, and you'll be pretty good in a 24-hour period. That'll be a pretty good marker for what your bowel will tolerate. So, like, for example, if a flush takes you 20 grams, you know, your bowel could probably tolerate 10 grams a day pretty easy. Now, you may try that 10 grams. Let's say it took you 20 grams to flush, and you took that 10 grams a day, but you weren't tolerating it. Just cut it back. That's the other way. I mean, if you're not tolerating it, if it's causing loose bowels and it's causing a lot of gas, just cut it back. There's no magic to this as far as like the exact right, because everybody's unique and different. My magic number just happens to be about 5 grams, but I've got people that come to see me who are, you know, their baseline dose is 12 or 15 or 20 grams a day. And I've got other people who can't tolerate more than a gram. So if you fall in that lower 1 gram category, don't let that freak you out. That's okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Osborne, I know you're busy, and we really appreciate your time, but I've got to ask you, because Beth and I have talked about this. What are your thoughts about vitamin C infusions, which I'm hearing more and more about?
It's the quickest way. It's the quickest way to get vitamin C levels up. I mean, what you can do with an infusion, you can't do orally. So I think if, for example, for people that have cancers, for people that have really severe acute inflammation and they're looking for some type of immediate relief, IV vitamin C is a really good way to get that level up and potentially provide them with some benefit.
That's great. That's good. Well, again, I am just so appreciative of your time, and I've learned a lot, and we have a ton more questions, but it's time, I think, to wrap it up. So, Again, we really sincerely appreciate your time, Dr. Osborne, and thanks for what you do. And we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
It was my pleasure. It was a joy to have this conversation with you today. And thanks for having me on.
Wow, Scott, was that an amazing interview?
It really was. It was very educational. He really knows his stuff, doesn't he?
Oh my gosh. I've only met him in person once, but I've talked to him on the phone a couple of times. And what I love about Dr. Osborne is that he encourages people to make their own healthcare decisions based on research and partnering with a healthcare professional. And again, I was just thrilled to have him on the show today.
I agree. That really resonated with me. And you know, Beth, I've said it before, but I'll say it again, is that as an allopathic doctor, as a Western doctor, I feel like there's a lot of answers out there that we don't have, and that, you know, people should go out and certainly just try and make their own choices with education and guidance from guys like Dr. Osborne, you know. And I think that there's a nice balance between the two worlds. And I just think that providers like him are a really good resource for folks.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I just want to thank our listeners, you know, for joining us today. And as always, I hope everyone enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Osborne as much as I did. You know, the purpose of the show is to educate everyone on different new avenues in the health and wellness world. So I really, again, want to encourage everyone to visit our show's landing page, be a subscriber, and look at the other shows at Up to Me Radio. And don't forget about our Facebook page and our Twitter page at Up to Me Radio. So I guess with that, I mean, it was a great show. And I personally would like to wish everyone a Merry Christmas. And as well as you, you're such a dear friend of mine, Dr. Clitheroe, and I think the world of you. So with that, I guess we're going to be closing the show.
Thank you, Beth. Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy New Year.